Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
To welcome you to another edition of The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy Noble, welcoming you on this beautiful Thursday afternoon, at least here in the Show Me State. It is a beautiful Thursday afternoon, and that means we are one day away from the weekend. Hopefully, most of you and me will have some time off to just sit back and rest and relax. Like I said, it's a beautiful Thursday here in the Show Me State. Fall, but 74 degrees, and I'm enjoying it, even though I'm inside here at my computer with my glass of raspberry lemonade tea. I hope you're enjoying it wherever you are, and I hope you just have a couple of hours of free time, if that's possible. We have so much to talk about here on The Cross in the Desert. The subtitle, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran, that's what I do. There's so much to talk about. In the last 2 weeks, so much has happened. So I want to bring you up to date. I want to mention in passing here that I have a half-hour blog talk by the same name, The Cross in the Desert. And usually I produce that on a Monday and a Wednesday and throughout the week. And it's a half-an-hour format, not like the two-hour one here, with the special call-in guests, but it's a half-an-hour kind of a magazine format, and we talk about the issues in Iran, a little bit of a Bible teaching, a couple of interviews of interest for you. Just to let you know, we're trying here on The Cross in the Desert to reach many, many people. I want to say in particular I'm very thankful that my friends in Iran, they can listen in on the link. A lot of the time, it's really hard for them because of the slow internet speed, and the situation in Iran is pretty desperate. They have to listen and watch Facebook and proxy with VPN because it's banned, even though the Supreme Leader and the President have a Facebook and Twitter account for themselves. It's still banned for everyone else. Imagine that, but that's true, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. So we have the program out there, and I'm very, very, very glad that you've taken the time to listen, because The Cross in the Desert is a program of hope and freedom, speaking out and praying for my friends in Iran. This is the goal, and this is what I enjoy doing, because they're my dear friends. They so desperately want to be able to sit here with this glass of raspberry lemonade and do anything they want, to get on the computer and go anywhere they want and to enjoy life just like you and me, but that is not the case. So The Cross in the Desert exists to make life a little better and a little easier for them that are behind the iron curtain, if you will, of a dictatorship regime in Iran. Now, I wanted to bring you up to date. 2 weeks ago, on September 26th, there was a very special prayer vigil, actually worldwide prayer vigil, for Saeed Abedini. He's my Facebook friend. He's an American pastor held captive in Iran because of his Christian faith. And I want to tell you some of the things that happened during that week leading right up to the prayer vigil. Some amazing things that can only be the hand of God that caused it to happen. Well, let me give you an example. As you well know, President Rouhani made a special visit. The president of Iran came to the United Nations the week of September 25th, and he was there, and he met with some people. We're going to talk a little bit later that he talked with President Obama. We're going to talk about that. But it happens to be that Rouhani, the president of Iran, was staying at the very same hotel as Negma Abedini, who is the wife of Saeed, who is in prison in Iran. Imagine that. So here is my friend Negma. She's having an interview in the lobby of the hotel in New York. Imagine this. And in walks the entourage, that is the delegation for President Rouhani. Well, can you imagine that? Her husband is in Iran, in prison, and here comes the delegation, the new president of Iran. Could you put yourself in her place for a minute and imagine the excitement and the adrenaline flow of seeing this? Well, she stopped what she was doing, and she ran over to that entourage. She had a letter written by her husband, Saeed, in Evan prison, that he wanted to have delivered to the very president of Iran. And what do you know? The delegation is right there. Now, unfortunately, the president himself wasn't present, but the security guard was there and other people that associate with him. And she walked over to it, brave woman that she is, and hand-delivered this letter to one of the guards. And she spoke in the native language she knows well, Farsi, introduced herself, was very polite, was very respectful, and asked if he would give this letter to the president. Now, he said he would. We don't have confirmation that he did, but can you imagine just for a second, here you are fighting day and night, praying, speaking out day and night to get your husband free, and you are a few feet away from one of the people that can speak and get your husband free. Well, also, just to let you know what's going on here, that week also, Rouhani promised the release of 80 or so political prisoners. Now, there has been quite a few released. One important one was the human rights attorney, Nazrin Sotoudeh, who I've been speaking out for on my Facebook page. She was actually freed. But a lot of these other political prisoners only had a year or a few months left on their sentence. And what I'm trying to say is we need to somehow look beyond the diplomatic, moderate stance of Rouhani. And we're going to find out today that he really isn't the moderate that he claims to be. On my program today, I have a very, very special guest. In the next 20 minutes, we're going to talk to her. Her name is Nazrin Mohammadi. Nazrin Mohammadi is the sister of Akbar Mohammadi. Akbar Mohammadi was arrested in 1999 and put in Evan prison because he started a freedom of expression movement, if you will, on the campuses of universities in Iran. And, of course, that doesn't sit well with the regime. But I think that Nazrin is going to explain a little bit about Rouhani and Iran. She used to live there. She has a lot of information, a lot of insight that you're going to want to stand by and listen to. And that's coming up within the next 20 minutes. She's going to tell us who Rouhani really, really is. She knows a little bit about Iranian presidents, a little bit about the happenings of Iran because she once lived there. She's got a very, very special testimony to tell us about her brother. It's based on the book she wrote called Ideas and Lashes. It's the story of her brother, his prison diary, and what he suffered in prison. So please stay tuned for that. But getting back to what I was saying during that week, we have this amazing, amazing prayer vigil worldwide, over 70 cities, some other countries. As far as East Jerusalem, there was a prayer vigil for Saeed Abedini. And the day after the prayer vigil, the very next day as if an answer to our prayers. For the first time in over 34 years, an American president talked with an Iranian president. President Obama, to his credit, called President Rouhani in Iran. They spoke on phone, not in person, and he called for the release of Saeed Abedini. Well, this is huge. This is a step in the right direction because our president has been so silent for so long, and we have been crying out, petitioning, and speaking out that he would do something. And I believe he heard us. I have to believe that in some way. And the next day after the prayer visual, this was the result, him speaking out and calling for Saeed's release. Well, this was an incredible week as far as the happenings in Negma's life, the progress, the fight that we've been going through, and seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. And what I want to do right now, I want to play you a short clip from Jordan Seculo, who was in Washington for the prayer visual Thursday, September 26th. And he had a few important things to say about it, and we're going to hear that right now on the cross in the desert.
Jordan Seculo, the executive director of the American Center for Law and Justice, has been a loud, prophetic voice for religious freedom and human rights around the world. He's representing Saeed and Nagmeh and the family, their interests both here in Iran. He's coming now. We'll introduce some of our special guests. Let's welcome Jordan Seculo. Jordan.
Thank you. Folks, as we gather here today, actually at this moment, Nagmeh Abedini, Pastor Saeed's wife, an American citizen, Pastor Saeed, an American, is speaking in Boise, Idaho, doing the same thing that we're doing. She's outside her state capital at this exact moment. That's why we planned for 2 p.m. She's on mountain time. Nagmeh, as you may have seen in the last few days, was able to approach the Iranian delegation at the United Nations as they were going through a hotel lobby, the president's delegation, as well as the foreign minister's spokesperson for Iran. So we now know, after Christian Amanpour asked the new president of Iran specifically about Saeed, that no more can Iran claim to not know, its top leader not know, about this imprisoned American pastor who is imprisoned only because of his Christian faith. You know, it's typical of Iran, when they bring charges against people like this, to accuse them of being spies, or to say they're Zionist, or they're a spy for America, they're a spy for Israel, they're some real kind of threat, or they're a criminal. And we've seen that before. But Iran was much bolder this time with Pastor Saeed. They accused him of being a national security threat because of work he did with house churches dating from 2000 to 2005. Now, he's made 9 trips to Iran since 2009, long after the charges that were brought against him. It wasn't a crime from 2000 to 2005 to work with house churches. There was a different president. This was before Ahmadinejad. So we now have a U.S. citizen, an American, sitting in one of the worst prisons in the world, sitting when he can. Because when he's in solitary confinement, he's in a 2x2 cell where you can't sit or stand. And he's there only because of his Christian faith. Secretary Kerry, as we speak, is actually meeting with the P5 plus one. That includes Iran's foreign minister today, right now, on the one-year anniversary of Saeed's imprisonment. 52 weeks he has been in jail because he's a Christian. You know, we had a letter-writing campaign because of Saeed. And let me see if my team can hand me this from the New York Times today. Because Saeed wrote a letter to the new president appealing to him on his own rhetoric of being a moderate. So we said, well, we should write letters too. And our first goal was 52,000, 1,000 for each week Saeed had been in jail. We hit that in a few days. So we said, what can we do to make it bigger? So we said, okay, 104,000 by today. We hit that yesterday. And as of the last time I checked, as I was walking over here today, we're at over 115,000 people who have joined Saeed, but also Reverend Billy Graham, who today took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, a letter to the president of Iran appealing for him to release Saeed. Now, folks, for all of you who came today in the middle of the day on a work day, and for everybody watching and for everybody praying at home, I know it's not easy to be here. This does not happen. These meetings don't happen. The coverage doesn't happen without all of you. It takes 100,000 people. It takes the over 600,000 people on our petition, but it also takes our government.
This is so important that you heard this, because right now on my computer, I'm on the BeHeardProject.com page for Saeed Abedini, who's still in Iran, as you heard from Jordan Sekulow. There's been much progress made, but you can make a difference in actually writing the president of Iran yourself. So far on a petition for Saeed's freedom, I have 626,577 signatures. There has already been over 100,000 letters written to the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani. I really urge you to go to BeHeardProject.com. And it's a page. You'll see a picture of Saeed there. There'll be some information on current cases. And you can go to this page and scroll down and write a letter to the president of Iran. And you may think, well, really, is he going to get these letters? Is he really going to read them? And yes, he is. It will be delivered to him, much like the way that Nagma delivered her letter. This is really important for you and me to do. I've signed this, and it's a thrill. You can write, and you can speak out for your brother in prison who is there because of his Christian faith. So even though there has been progress, and there is light at the end of the tunnel, we still have much work speaking out and praying to do. And we want to grow this petition into the millions. We want these letters to reach that goal as well, too. He has no reason to not know about Saeed and many other Christian prisoners. He has no reason now. It's very clear that the president knows about this case. There is no reason to be ignorant anymore. And so I really feel as though the Lord is continuing to instruct us to continue to pray and to speak out. Well, I mentioned before the stance that Rouhani takes is one of being a moderate, but there are some things happening that make me doubt that a lot. I really believe, as most Iranian activists tell me, the supreme leader has the final say in everything. Rouhani amounts to a diplomatic pawn. So what's going on since Iran has elected a new president? Has things really, really changed? Well, we had the release of some political prisoners, but executions. I have this here from the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, the director Hadi Gahini. He's the executive director. He has this to say about Rouhani. While Rouhani is busy promoting a softer image of Iran internationally during his visit to New York 2 weeks ago, it was business as usual on the domestic front with scores of prisoners put to death following unfair trials. Since Rouhani's inauguration, Hadi says, the increasing number of prisoners being sent to the gallows is indefensible. How many? Well, in the 2 weeks between September 11th and September 25th, Iranian officials hanged a record 50 individuals. What was their crimes? Primarily for drug-related offenses. There's no rehabilitation. There's no help for these people. There is no fair trial for them. Today, October 10th, is the World Day Against the Death Penalty. And really what the International Human Rights Committee in Iran is saying is they're calling on the judiciary to review these sentencing guidelines that allow for the use of capital punishment and revise them in accordance with international standards. This unfairness, to me, says a lot about the so-called moderate reform, if you will, of President Rouhani. And you may think I'm being a little harsh on him. I don't think so, because he has something to say, maybe not the final word. Continued business as usual in Iran. Have things really changed? Is this all about easing the sanctions against them? Is this all about saving face on the nuclear program? Probably. And it's always image building, playing politics. And this goes on and on, not just in Iran, but in any political circle, playing politics with the lives of people. How destructive. The same thing happening here in my country with the shutdown of the government. It amazes me. We, the people, sometimes we get our face stepped upon by our elected officials. And so as I'm saying this about Rouhani, I'm reflecting on my own situation here as a citizen. My government is shut down. That's a travesty indeed. So please go to that page, the Be Heard Project. Please put your name on that page because it's so, so important to speak out for Saheed. I want to make mention before we head towards our interview of another happening in Iran that is mind-boggling. Did you know that Iran has passed a law allowing men to marry their 13-year-old adopted daughters? I'm not exaggerating. There is a law in Iran that allows men to marry their adopted daughters at the age of 13. And again, this is all happening in spite of the moderate claim by Rouhani. The law was approved by the Iranian members of parliament and maintains that girls can marry with the permission of their father at the age of 13 and young boys at the age of 15. It's mind-boggling. The timing of this law being passed through the legal hurdle, it comes right after Rouhani met with Obama. And the law in question pertains to the legal marriage age. But here's the concern. It's incest. The bill is legalizing pedophilia. And you have to understand, you may say, well, that's that culture, but that's incest. It's not part of the Iranian culture to marry an adopted child. And yet we see this rise in incest in Iran and other countries as well. And this bill, in essence, is legalizing pedophilia and endangering children and normalizing that kind of crime. They have nothing to say, really. It will allow for girls as young as 13 to get married. Man, it's amazing. I'm looking at pictures here. I wish you could see this, of these young Iranian girls in their hijab. It's like they're standing in line, children being married, stepfathers marrying their adopted children. Where is the shame? We have a lack of shame in our culture. The things that should be shameful, we participate in. And here is a graphic example. Now, I want to make mention to you about petitions. I'll have this on my page. It is a Facebook petition where you can go and speak out about this. My friend Gitti actually sent it to me, and I will get it back up on the page. I want to see if I can find it really quick for you. It is amazing that this is even legalized, but it is. The name of the page is An End to Legalize Pedophilia and Child Rape in Iran. And you can go to this page, and you can sign this. There so far has been 2,468 signatures to this. I will definitely have this back up on my page. You can come to my Facebook page and definitely speak out and let your voice be heard. So those are the happenings. I say this. There's some encouraging things happening with the case of the Christian pastor, but with the executions, with the laws that are being passed in Iran, it looks to me like business as usual. Well, there are many, many more things we're going to talk about in this two-hour special program. We're going to talk about a lot of the personal communication I have with my friends in Iran. They have written me some things that I want to share with you because this really is their program. I love being their voice, and I have some things I want to share with you, some of the blogs I want to read to you that I've written that pertain to issues in Iran. I have one that just will break your heart, and I'll share that with you later. And then I want to talk about an issue later on after our interview about suicide, the rate of suicide among women in Iran. And I have a good friend named Nassim who wrote a heartbreaking article about this. It talks about her sister. And I want to share that with you. There is just so many things happening, so many good things happening, and so many things I want to share with you about the happenings in Iran. But we're going to take this short music break right now. This is Matt Redman, and you're going to hear him right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Of the shadow of death, your heart flickers.
with the talented Matt Redman, You Never Let Go. Beautiful song. Welcome back to The Cross in the Desert. I want to recognize some people in our chat room right now. Luchadora, Measure of Faith, Patriot Greg, Vito, and some other guests. Thank you so much for spending your day with us. I'm speaking of Kel Fritzy, my awesome producer in the background that makes this show happen. She's really a wonderful producer and host of her own program as well, as we talk about the religion of Islam. I got a very special guest on the line right now. Her name is Nazrin Mohammadi. She is the author of the book Ideas and Lashes, The Prison Diary of Akbar Mohammadi. It's the story of her brother. And I want to welcome you to The Cross in the Desert, Nazrin. Thank you for being here.
Hello, dear Randy, and hello, everybody. Thank you so much.
You know, this is a very powerful book, and we're going to talk about the life of your brother. But what I want to do before we talk about that, Nazrin, I want to go back to when you lived in Iran as a young girl. Just a couple of days ago, Nazrin, I was talking on a video chat with a young Iranian girl, and the subject of the government and freedom came up, and her answer to me was, well, I'm okay with the government. And it really kind of shocked me that she didn't seem to have the same objections that we would have about the lack of freedom there. So before you tell me about your background, help me with this young Iranian girl. Why would someone living in Iran under oppression and fear, why would they say that they're okay with the government? Can you help us with that?
Sure, dear Andy. I knew and we knew what's going on in Iran. There are more than 70 million people in Iran. Among these people, one can definitely find some people as a pro-regime. There are 10 to 15% who are either family, agents, or related somehow to the regime. These people are enjoying themselves through the wealth earned by corruption, bribery, and things like that. But the vast majority of people in Iran are suffering every day any objection or criticism to the government means spending long time in jail or being tortured. There is no justice for our people. Actually, when a petty thief steals something like a piece of bread because he or she is hungry, the government chops their hands. But the corrupted government or their agents are stealing millions of dollars of our nation, going unpunished, and nobody can touch them. All the execution, hanging, stoning, death are mostly applied to the majority of the people. Normally, not to those 10 to 15% pro-Islamic government.
There are the majority of people that are suffering, as you point out, and there are those that are bribed, that are drawn to the government, relationships, family, so they're afraid to speak out. Iran does not want the world to know about the gross violations of human rights. They want to keep that as secret as possible. And so it's to their advantage that no one knows really what goes on there. But, of course, you did. You grew up in Iran as a child. Tell our audience a little bit about what life was like growing up in Iran.
Living in Iran is not easy, especially for women. The hardest thing I remember is the day that my school teacher tried to take us to watch a woman being stoned to death. I was almost 7 years old, little kid. I did not want to go because my parents did not allow me. I didn't know what is stoning. I didn't know what's going on. I can never forget about a nightmare that my close friend had after going to the thing. She was depressed for several months and could not come to the school. When I saw her, she was like a statue and her tears was coming. That nightmare happened to my close friend, a little girl, I never forget for the rest of my life. This is experience, you know, the worst experience I had in my life.
The way women are treated in Iran, you brought up women. If they go out publicly and their hijab is not worn properly, if they have makeup on, if there's too much skin shown, they have what's called the morality police, the Gashti or Shad, that will actually arrest them.
Yes.
So women don't have real freedom in Iran. Isn't that not true?
It's true. They don't have any freedom in Iran. When they go outside, you're afraid. They're afraid, you know, the police or agent of government, they're coming and telling or arresting them or taking them to the jail. The women in Iran, they cannot breathe. Being the most of people in the world, they know what's going on in the whole Islamic government. It doesn't matter which country. All countries, they are Islamic. They don't have freedom. They don't have any human rights.
And I was mentioning before you came on that there seems to be a predominant despair among women, that many of the women, because of the male-dominated patriarchal society, many of them because they don't want that for a lifestyle, some of the women, actually a large part of the women, in their life they commit suicide. When you lived in Iran before you came here to live, did you hear a lot about women taking their own life because of that?
Yes, I heard. I saw I had a friend in university in Iran, and her sister, she had a suicide, and she burned her body, and when she was dying, she said, "I want to be alive," but she was almost death, and nobody could help her. When they took her to hospital, she wasn't alive. There are many women that are, you know, killing themselves. It's true.
And I don't know if you heard before you came on that there is a new law in Iran now. The Islamic regime has passed a law where a stepfather is now allowed to marry his 13-year-old adopted daughter. And it just seemingly gets worse for women living in Iran.
Dear Randy, in Iran, there is no freedom for men and women, especially women. You know, the guy can marry with, you're telling me, 13 years. Still, uh-huh. We see the guy can marry 11, 12 years old girl, a little girl, not all of part of Iran. I'm not talking about the open mind in Iran. Some Islamic people, you know, they are so religious. They believe their daughter, when become to 9 years old, she's adult, she can marry. Yeah, there are happened a lot in Iran. A guy can marry with four women and can have a lot of women around himself. This is Islam. This is Islamic government. I'm not talking about the all Iranian people. For example, for my family, and there are many open-minded family in Iran, they are almost all of Iranians are educated. They are open-minded. They don't believe Islamic government. They don't believe Islam. And they don't believe this law. I'm not talking about the majority of people. I'm talking about the sum of people, you know, the religious people, or pro-government people. Yes, it's true. Is this one happen a lot in Iran?
What I want to do now is I want to shift gears a little bit, since people have an idea a little bit of the culture and what it's like living there. Let's talk about your dear brother, Akbar. The book I'm holding in my hands, Ideas and Lashes, The Prison Diary of Akbar Mohammadi. We're talking about the subject of freedom, which is a precious, precious gift from God for all human beings. Tell me a little bit about your brother. What do you want people to know about him as a human being? In other words, tell me what he was like growing up being your brother. Tell us a little bit about Akbar and what are the things that he stood for.
Akbar, I think he was an angel for my life and many students' life and many people in Iran. Even though I love all my family, I had a special relation with Akbar. He could never bear my sadness. He always tried to make me laugh. I was so close to him. Akbar was a human rights and political activist. He could not stand the injustice. 9th of July, 1999, Iranian students in Tehran University had the biggest rally ever after the revolution in 1979. He was one of the main organizers. He was arrested days after. And Akbar, my brother Akbar, was a man of peace. He believed that an honorable death is 1,000 times greater than living in disgrace. Akbar believed he was a really human. He was a true follower of Gandhi, Martin Luther King. He also admired Nelson Mandela's tolerance and endowment.
So he had people he looked up to that their philosophies, their way of life is something he admired. And you mentioned a Martin Luther King, certainly a great civil rights leader here. And then, of course, Gandhi in India. And their lifestyles and their philosophies are something that he admired and carried with him into Iran. He was taking their ideas and for democracy and freedom and talking to Iranians. Is that right?
Yes, the Arandi. As far, he was a man of peace. I cannot believe that the price of a simple expression of mind of a young student could be a human life. I remember once I was talking to my brother Akbar before he Nasrin, more than 25 centuries ago, Cyrus, the great king of Persia, gifted the human right to the world for free. But it seems that right now human rights for Iranian is going to cost us dearly. My brother, I don't know, should I explain to you more about him, or you're going to ask me questions?
Well, I wanted to ask you, since he's a man of peace and freedom, and he followed after Gandhi and King, and he wanted people to have that freedom, he was part of the university movement in 1999.
Yes.
And what happened there in 1999 that changed his life and changed your life?
In 1999, there was a huge demonstration in Iran. More than thousands of students there were on the streets and chanted, "We want freedom." And the regime arrested all students and killed several students in demonstration. In that time, the regime arrested my two brothers. Akbar was one of them. Akbar was a leader of students in that time. After several months, almost all of the students got set free, except my brother with several students. Regime tortured my brothers a lot and took him to jail for 7 years. Akbar was tortured extensively, and you cannot believe it. But when the regime was torturing him in the prison, Irwin prison, he was shouting, "Viva freedom! Down with the dictator!" The regime was torturing him all in the name of Islam. But
in your book, Ideas and Lashes, I was coming across one of the things that Akbar mentioned. This book that you wrote, Nasrin, is his prison diary. It's about him explaining from prison what is happening to him in a diary. And you mentioned he was tortured, and I was reading in one of the chapters the description of the kind of torture that your brother endured. And he writes, "Before they took me to begin the flogging with the cable, the interrogator said to me, 'This time we will whip your feet so hard that you will not even be able to wear Papa Noel's Santa Claus shoes.'" That's his own words. And Akbar writes, at that time, I did not understand the meaning of this threat, but then I understood. My feet were all swollen from the beating so that I could not even wear slippers. I was in so much pain that I could not even wear shoes when going to the bathroom. I was in terrible pain. I could not walk. And he explains that they took steel cables and whipped the bottom of his feet. And that is unimaginable, the things that your brother suffered.
Yes. He was tortured extensively. And regime, guard of regime told my parents, the word torture we did to Akbar because he was too strong. He never gave up. He didn't be surrender, and he was, you know, regime was torturing him. He always telling and shouting and chanting, we want freedom and viva freedom. And that regime, you know, tortured him a lot.
And there was one situation where he describes that he was actually hung upside down for a period of time. And they tortured him. It would ask him the same questions over and over again. If he was working for the CIA, if his brother was financially providing for him, and they would ask him questions, and he would tell them the truth, and he wouldn't lie, and they would still continue to torture and beat him, and in one instance, hanging him upside down. But I wanted to ask you this. In spite of everything that your brother endured, he actually stood up for many of the prisoners in the prison, and he did kind things for them, not thinking of himself, but thinking of them. Isn't that right?
It's right. In the book, it's written. That reason, the many prisoners, they loved him. And some of them are free. They are living in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. When they came to here, they were talking about how was Akbar strong, how was loyal to them, and how much helped to them, how much he sacrificed himself for others. Yes, it's true, and his diary written what he do, and many prisoners, they told me this story. Akbar was so strong, and he stood against the Islamic government. And regime knew he is so strong guy, and he is against with them, real, you know, fighter, and against to them. And they torture him a lot, and he was so sick because of torturing him. When he was in sick leave, and the regime took him again to jail, he was taking 30 pills every day. He was so sick. He had a sore injury because of regime tortured him a lot. Yeah. They shouldn't take him by law in the jail. But the agent of regime took him to jail. My brother Akbar, when the regime took him to jail, and they refused to take his pill to him. And then Akbar decided, and he went and hungry fight and said he would continue his fight for freedom inside prison until all political prisoners are set free.
Yes, and you know, I remember you explaining that to me, and I remember you telling me a story, too, that someone had called you or called your parents and made a promise, and this is in 2006. He's been in Evan prison now for 7 years, since 1999, and you got a phone call one day with someone on the other end of the line promising your parents that he was going to be free in 3 days. And this was an event in your life that's very, very painful to remember. But I need to ask you, if you will, describe what happened when you got that phone call about your brother.
It's really painful for me. Sure, I will explain to you. In my second book, I told you I'm writing almost, I'm done. I wrote about this, what happened. You know, in that time I was living in United States. My family, my parents decided to meet me in Turkey. Since going to Iran for me was not an option, therefore I went to Turkey mid-July 2006. It was around 8 a.m. in the morning. In breakfast time. On August 2006. In that time, my father's cell was ringing, and it was called from a friend. He was a student in Iran. His name was Behnam, and he said, "For what the phone?" He asked to my father, "For what the phone?" To your brother, Murad, my uncle. My uncle took the phone and he was talking, and I understood he suddenly left the living room. I was afraid. I don't know, 3 days before this phone. This happened 3 days before. Same guy, Behnam, called us, and he told us Akbar is going to be free in 3 days. We had a party, we had a dance. You know, about 13 people, all family from Iran, my brother, sisters, my parents, my niece, little niece, 3 years, and 7 years and 8 years old niece and nephew. They were in Turkey, Ankara. We were dancing and happy, and so happy, drinking wine, and got party. After 3 days, that morning, when it happened, my uncle was answering the phone, and he went to that bedroom, the forest bedroom, to the living room. I got suspicious to him. Why he left immediately the living room? I got worried about Akbar. I thought he's so sick. I thought physically he got so sick, he's in hospital, or something like that. I ran, and immediately I went to the same my uncle was over. I grabbed the phone from my uncle's hand. I don't know, God knows what happened. And then I grabbed the phone. I went to another bedroom and closed the door, shut the door. I thought, hello, and I heard Behnam's voice. I said, Behnam, this is Nasreen. Tell me what happened. I am a strong lady. Don't be afraid. I thought he's going to tell me Akbar is so sick. He's in hospital and like that. And then He thought, I'm ready. He told me, Nasrin, Akbar was killed last night by Islamic regime under torture in the prison. In that time, God knows what happened to me. Like the apartment was spinning around my eyes. I was shouting just no, 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 loudly. And my tears was coming on my face. My eyes were open. My mouth was open. I was screaming. My parents came, my mom and dad. From front and back, they tried held me tightly. And my dad tried to close my mouth because just I was shocked and screaming. And my eyes were open. My parents tried to set me down. And then told me, why you are crying? The regime killed Akbar? Did you hear this from my phone? Why are you crying? We knew one day this Islamic regime going to kill our son. Be strong. Be proud of your brother's path. He chose this way. Why are you crying? My mom, I am so proud of my mom.
Your parents were very strong through this because they knew going on, because of his stance, because of his beliefs, and because of his love for freedom, they knew that the very regime that they were living under would one day do this to him because he had a love for freedom. I have a question here about freedom. One of the people in the chat room want to know, what do Iranians consider true freedom? What is the standard of true freedom for Iranians? Something that your brother would believe in. One of the people want to know, what is it that Iranians consider true freedom?
As far as Iranian people are concerned, I think they can become the voice of, you know, our people outside the country, because there is no free press in Iran. I also believe that united we will stand, and divided we will fall. And I have a message for American people. I don't know, do you have time or
yes,
no?
Yes, go right ahead. Give us your message.
First, I honor my late brother, Akbar. I'm following his path and pursue his dreams. My message to American people and all the world is to help our people by demanding their government to condition any relation with Islamic Republic on human rights before opening any diplomatic relations. This is my message to American people and the world.
So you want, before we talk diplomatically with Iran, your message would be that the government should demand the freedom of political prisoners under the Islamic regime. Is that right?
Yes. And I believe this Islamic regime should be changed and we shouldn't overthrow. I believe that. And I never forget and give this Islamic regime of Iran it to my brother and my family and many young people and students and many in Iran. You know, we have many prisoners, and the regime killed many people in Iran.
One of the nice things I like about your book, Nazrin, you finished part of the book after your prison diary, after Akbar's prison diary came to an end before his death, of course. And the other part of the book, you mentioned the things that you did in your brother's name. And one of the nicest things that's happened to you and your family is that our former President George W. Bush, actually your brother Manachur, got to visit him in the White House, but he recognized Akbar as a person of freedom. And because of that, you sent him a copy of your book. And I've got a letter here from George W. Bush. It's dated September 10th of this year. And he has something nice to say to you for sending him your book. It says, "Dear Nazrin, thank you for the inscribed copy of you and your brother's book, Ideas and Lashes, The Prison Diary of Akbar Mohammadi. It looks like a moving tribute to your brother. I appreciate your thoughtful gesture, and I'm touched by your determination to honor his life and legacy. Laura and I send you our best wishes. Sincerely, George W. Bush." I want to ask you something about this. The former president, George W. Bush, honored your brother and made a public announcement about that, and he even wrote you this nice letter honoring your brother. What do you think about our current president? Do you think that he has the same honor for those that have died in Iran under unjust circumstances? Do you think that he should maybe speak out and honor those that have been hurt in Iran like George W. Bush has in the past?
I don't believe this is our president. I'm a citizen in the United States. I'm an American. I love this country. I love American people. But I'm not agree with the government. This government is friend with Islamic regime of Iran. He's not like President George Bush. I admire and love President George W. When he was a president, and I still love him. I'm a Republican, but President Obama, he's not friend with people. He's friend with government. Do you remember 5 years ago when the students were on the street and chanted, "President Obama, are you with us or with Mullah?" Yes, President Obama was and he is still with Mullah. He's supporting this Islamic government. He doesn't care about the people in Iran. He's selling Iranian people. He's selling our nation.
I well remember the 2009 presidential election. I wonder if our listeners remember the violence and the outcry of Iranians wanting support and got none from our current president, who has not taken a stand for them. And the only time there has been any recognition of any evil going on there by President Obama is when he saw the video of Netta Sultan dying in the alleyway, being shot by a Basiji man. And, of course, the whole world saw that incredible video. And I remember that he did mention that that was horrible, what happened to Netta as he watched the video. But we have never heard President Obama stand up until this past week calling for Saeed's release. He has not been vocal against the injustices of the people of Iran. I want to ask you one last question before I let you go. Your book, Ideas and Lashes, is really the prison diary of your brother. What is the main message people will get from reading this book? What do you think they should learn the best about your brother?
I want to, you know, all world, especially American people, they know what's going on in Iran and what is the Islamic government. And, you know, my late brother, when he wrote his diary in Iran, he had a wish to not to Iranian people to read this book, because Iranian people, they know what's going on in Iran. American, European, those people, you know, from outside of Iran, they don't know what's going on in Iran. And he wanted the world to know that what is really going on in this, in the Persians of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He wanted to show how barbaric is this Islamic regime is. And
your brother has a message in this book for those that don't know what's going on in Iran. I got an additional question I just thought of as you was explaining that. A lot of people, even some of my friends in Iran, are questioning maybe there's hope with the new president. Tell me your thoughts on what you think about that. What about this new president of Iran? Does he really mean he's going to reform things and make changes? What do you think?
There is no hope. Reform doesn't have any meaning to me. And this is game in Iran. The government playing game. Like when President Khatami's time, my brothers in that time were arrested. And they were under torture. He was reform too. And this is a game, just a game. They are from government. He's a mullah. He's supporting government. He's a, just, you know, like one of them. After this president, when he came to United States, same time in Iran, many people were executed and hanged. And just some people got free. And we have many prisoners, you said, like Said Abidjani, and many, you know, the people wanted the regime be changed or overthrew. But Islamic regime, they're not going to, you know, free them. And I'm proud of you because, you know, many friends in Iran, and you know many Iranian people, and you have many information about the Islamic government. But this president is one of Islamic government. Nothing going to be changed. And still, they are going to killing people, hanging, and executing, and there is no freedom in Iran. It's like so funny, you know, you telling me in dictatorship, you know, all Islamic government, they are dictatorship. There is no peace, no freedom in any country. Islamic government they have it. Look at the Iraq, look at Egypt, look at Syria. Are you seeing any peace or freedom in those countries? No, there isn't. Rouhani never changed anything, and he's not changing anything. He's not going to bring any freedom in Iran. As you knew and I knew, this is a game, just a game from Islamic government. He's from.
I agree with you there, Nazrin. I know what you're saying, and I agree with it because it is political game playing with the people's lives and promising freedom when there's still bondage. I really, really want to thank you talking about your brother. I know this is really painful for you, but you stand with your brother's ideals, and you proclaim in his name the freedom that Iranians desperately want, and you are an activist yourself. And I thank you so much. We look forward to your new book. Thank you, Nazrin, for being my guest here today on The Cross in the Desert. Well, I try to bring you programs here with guests that know a lot about of what I'm talking about. And Nazrin lived through a horrible time in her life watching her brother die daily. He was a prisoner for 7 years and finally died in prison. Evin prison is a torture chamber. Our dear brother Saeed is there, and we pray for him every day. We speak out for him every day. When we think of Akbar and what he suffered, we know that Saeed and many others are suffering in many of the same ways. Just a month ago, I had Miriam and Marzea, who were in Evin prison and wrote a book called Captive in Iran, displaying the horrible psychological dimension of their captivity. Although they were not beaten like Saeed and or Akbar, they suffered some very spiritual and physical afflictions for being there in prison. And so I really appreciate my guest, Nazrin, for taking her time to articulate a very, very painful subject. If you want to read Akbar Mohammadi's diary, it's very powerful. He will let you know firsthand what life is like in Iran. It's very hard to read, but it's very necessary. The name of the book is Ideas and Lashes: The Prison Diary of Akbar Mohammadi. It's available up on Amazon.com. I want to take a really quick break here. We're going to listen to another song from Matt Redman, 10,000 Reasons, and we'll be right back on The Cross in the Desert.
Thank you so much, dear.
Bless the Lord, oh my soul, oh my soul. Worship His holy name. Sing like never before, oh my soul. I worship Your holy name. The sun comes up. Is failing, the end draws near. and my time has come. Still my soul will sing your praise unending. 10,000 years and then forevermore. Forevermore. Bless the
does a tremendous job. He's just a wonderful, gifted artist. Just an incredible lady, Nazra Mohammadi, expressing from the heart, saying from the heart, talking about her brother. She's such a fighter, and she stands for what she says. She is who she is. She doesn't back down. She loves this country. She loves the freedom that she has, and she loves living here. And I think more than anything, what she's trying to say is, wake up, America. Don't take your freedoms for granted. I come from a country where there's a dictatorship. And while we have problems, Americans have problems, we have problems with our government, nothing compares to that. And this is a country that's oppressed. This is a country that feels the pain and agony of no freedom every day. And I told you this program is about my Iranian friends, and I always ask them to give me their input. And I love when they write me little stories so I can read them to you, because I want to be their voice, and I want them to be center stage. This is not about Randy. This is about them. And just recently, I asked my friend Miriam, who lives in Tehran, to just summarize for me what freedom means to her. Since we're talking about the subject of freedom, what does freedom mean? And Miriam took the time to write this short little response to my question, and I want to read this to you. What freedom means to me, Miriam writes, freedom. The world, all people know it, believe in it, consider it as their primary right all over the world. Freedom entails their legal right to have their own beliefs, their favorite appearance, and their own activities and thoughts. Whatever make them feel free as humans without harming others. Regarding to the word harm, you tell me how my belief in truth could limit and harm others. How I pray, help people, I love them. How could that hurt them? Have you ever felt you can't breathe because you see cruelty and you're not allowed to say something, to shout, to scream? Freedom helps you make your choices for yourself. But what would happen if you had always to be afraid to make decisions because of limitations? Freedom is the right to live a decent life as you can without stepping in and telling others what to do or believe. This is anyone's right to express their opinions. We shouldn't be limited on what we can become. Freedom of speech and freedom of religion is our primary right. Freedom means to be able to learn from our mistakes. If I didn't have freedom, I would have to do what the top authorities always tell me to do, and then I don't have any room for mistakes. And how can I learn from my life? While we are under so much pressure, it makes it a stressful world to live in. Individual freedom is the absence of restraint on our ability to think and act for ourselves. The desire for freedom is in every human heart, and nobody exchanges it for anything. Wow. I asked her to answer a question, and she almost wrote me a speech. Did you hear what Miriam said? The question she asked? And she's talking, I know, about herself. Because you want to speak up and say something publicly, you want to write about it, but you're afraid you can't do it because of the consequences that you heard in the case of Akbar. Have you ever felt you can't breathe because you see cruelty and you're not able to say something, to shout, to scream? This is what she wants to be able to do what you and me do normally every day when we see injustice. We can shout and scream. We can print something. We can write something. We can text something. We can publicly say something here. We can say, that's wrong, just like our government officials. I don't want Obamacare. Here's why I don't want it. And Ted Cruz is a perfect example of that human right of freedom in a democracy or a republic where the Constitution is supposed to rule. He stood up for how many hours legislating, filibustering, saying, this is bad for us. He had the freedom to do it. No one arrested him. No one put him in jail. He didn't get tortured for that. Oh, I'm sure he was criticized by the left and liberals. Oh, okay, we can take that. But what Miriam is saying, I want to be like Ted Cruz, if you will. I want to shout. I want to scream. I want to cry out about injustices, but I can't because I'm afraid because of where I live. And it's hard for her. She wants to be able to be like that, to stand up publicly and say what's on her mind. I just so appreciate Miriam taking the time to just tell me what freedom means to her, because that's what it's all about. This is what the cross in the desert is all about. Speaking of Miriam, I want to take you to Mossa. Mossa is my friend. She currently is in India. I asked her why. Why did you leave Islam and become a Christian? Tell me why. Can you just spell it out and tell me why? Well, she took the time and she said, I abandoned Islam and I converted to Christianity. And she says, this makes me an apostate under the Islamic law of Iran. Therefore, she says, I have a well-founded fear of persecution, such as arrest, imprisonment, torture, and or death because of my religion and my membership in a particular social group. If I'm forced to return to Islam, she says, I understand all about the fear of what could happen to me because I know what the consequences are. Brave young girl. Now, she tells me her story. I want you to take just a minute to listen to her story. It's an amazing story. I was born in a Muslim family. Mossa writes, I practiced Islam in Iran, and after I arrived in India in 2004, I came to India with my parents, and they returned to Iran upon my father's completion of a PhD degree. She says, starting in 2007, I began to have some questions about my beliefs and practices in Islam. And my mother, who was the strictest Muslim in the family, she couldn't answer my questions. Her answer was that there are many secrets in the Quran, and it is not necessary for people to know these secrets and logics. In other words, be quiet. I could not find any answers to my questions, Mossa writes. Soon, I quit praying. In Islam, in Iran, it's called namaz, prayer, and did not practice most Islamic rituals. I only dressed as a Muslim woman because I was nominal, and she had to put on the dress. She says, soon I began researching other religions. One day in May 2007, I was in a coffee house with a friend, as she's talking about in India, and I had just finished my college exams and felt very depressed about my life. Suddenly, two girls came to us and gave us a little tract with the title, Somebody Loves You. At first, I thought it was like a gimmick. However, suddenly it occurred to me that perhaps this tract was about Jesus Christ. Then I asked myself, can Jesus love me, a Muslim girl? As someone from a Muslim background and knew that Jesus was sinless, he was born of a virgin, I concluded that Jesus must be really different from the other prophets, though. Well, right there I prayed to receive Jesus Christ as my Savior and Lord. It was after a while, Mossa writes, that I realized the group had produced the tract, the one that they gave the tract, that they had some strange beliefs. They were kind of cultish, so she kind of didn't participate with them any longer. And then later on, she said, during this time, I learned of Iranian Christian internet chat program. And she says, the folks in the internet chat room recommended that I join a Bible-believing church. And additionally, she says, I'm an evangelical Christian, and throughout these years, I shared my Christian faith with the people in India and the Iranian people there. She says, this includes some family members and friends. She witnessed to them about her faith and even mentioned why she left Islam. And then she talks about one day in November, 3 years ago, at a coffee house in India, she met two ladies holding a Bible. And Masa says, I approached them and asked if they knew a really good church. And they invited me to their own church, Disciples Community Church in Pune. It's in India. She says, at this church, I had been growing in my Christian faith. And she's continuing to fellowship on the Iranian Internet Church. Sounds like she's growing and her life is going in a positive direction. But now, here's what she writes. She says, at the same time as my parents learned of my conversion to Christianity, I began having some conflicts with them. My mother says that I never was an obedient child. She commands me to cut all contact with Christians because I'm born a Muslim and I will die as one. She says she prefers that I would be an atheist rather than a Christian. She always checks to see if I went to church on Sunday and bombards me with teachings of the Quran. She says, I am under a curse and God is angry with me. When my mother visited me in 2011, I challenged her to read the Bible and see how different it is from the Quran. And now she says, Masa says, my mom has given me a deadline that by the end of 2012, this was last summer, I must return to Iran. I can tell you she hasn't. This is when I graduate from Singhad College of Pharmacy. She says, if I have not abandoned Christianity, her own mother says that she is going to report her own daughter to the Islamic authorities. My parents treat me as if by becoming a Christian, I have done the equivalent of becoming a prostitute. Masa ends the statement saying to me, if I am forced to return to Iran, my religious confession will continue to be Jesus is God and he is the only way. For this confession, other Muslim background Christians have paid a high price in Iran, including with their life. There is another very brave Iranian girl, Masa. Her family is threatening to turn her in to the Islamic regime if she hasn't abandoned Christianity by the time she returns to Iran. I want you to think about that. Your own parents don't care. Islam is so sacred to them. The honor thing is so sacred among Muslims. The honor and shame in the culture of Islam is very, very strong. By her converting to Christianity, she has brought shame to her family to the extent that they will turn her in to the authorities. And then you think of honor killings, and you think of everything that happens in the world, and here is a perfect example of children who are betrayed because they become Christians. What I want to do now, I want to play for you another testimony of a former Muslim who embraced Jesus and the price that she paid. So let's listen to this particular testimony from a former Muslim woman.
According to the Islamic teaching, you cannot execute a virgin girl. So what they do, they rape them. They call it, you know, temporary marriages. That is what it happened to my 16-year-old friend. And then they executed her.
Ellie Davidian was horrified by such things as a teenager in Iran. Hers was a devout Muslim culture.
Give me an idea of what the daily rituals were when you were a child. Well, you have to get up so early in the morning, basically before sunrise, to perform the five times prayer that you start in the morning, and then you have noontime and the evening ritual makes you to feel like you gradually become a righteous person. Because personally, I was thinking I didn't commit any immoralities,
I did all the good works based on a, you know, young woman growing up in that country, trying to avoid, you know, sexual immoralities, alcohol, and everything.
When you became a teenager, you began to really question all of these things.
Well, I wanted to know more about what I was worshiping or whom I was worshiping and all these rituals. I was born near the border of Iran and Iraq. So during the war of Iran and Iraq, I saw so many dead people, layers of, you know, bodies one after another. I felt so I was betrayed by this God, because I was thinking, if there is a God, then why he is allowing all these things happening?
Ellie couldn't find answers anywhere, so she began to secretly deny Allah in her heart.
In Iran, after the revolution, we have to cover ourselves with dark, long, you know, chadors, long covering. And of course, in Islamic ritual, when they prepare the bodies to bury them, they have to cover them in a white, you know, sheets. And then you see blood. To me, that was the three colors, basically, that I was seeing in Iran. Black, white, and red.
For example, Ellie says that thousands of Iranian children were used to sweep minefields and then told they'd be martyrs for the cause of Allah.
There was a hatred growing inside of me against the Iranian government, against Islam, but still I have that fear to go to hell.
Ellie's parents wanted to help her, so they sent her away from the horrors of war.
And they thought, I'm going to lose my mind. I was putting all dark dresses. That's a sign of mourning inside of me. There was no joy inside of me. There was nothing, no life.
And they sent you to France.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, as I said before, it was like all colorful, and I was seeing at least freedom. But one thing brought to my attention was the churches in France. I was sensing some type of peace. I cannot explain it, you know, at that time. So I was just sitting in front of the statues of, you know, Jesus, lighting the candles in front of statues of Mary, and I was asking this God, whom I called Allah, what do you want to do with my life?
So you're in the Catholic Church in front of a statue of Jesus, talking to Allah.
I'm questioning him. What do you want to do with my life? What is the purpose?
Ellie came to America to finish college. There she saw a campus poster for the Jesus film. It was in her native language, Farsi, so she decided to see it.
Wow, these people really changed their Bible. Because whatever I was watching through Jesus' movie contradicted with the teaching of Islam about Jesus. So into my mind, I said, there has to be something wrong. Somebody has to lie.
Ellie had been taught to deny the deity of Jesus Christ. In fact, she had been taught that it was Judas who died on the cross, not Jesus.
Judas was a bad boy, so out of God's miracle, make Judas look like Jesus.
So Judas died on the cross.
Yes, according to teaching that I receive in Iran as a Shiite Muslim. So basically Christians are redeemed by the blood of Judas. So there is no atonement, there is no redemption. These are just revolutionary terms when you are talking to a Muslim. That's why they don't have any experience of God's grace.
Then Ellie met some Iranian Christians and started to make a connection. She asked God to show her the truth. And that night she had a dream.
And I woke up, even though he didn't say, I am Jesus. He talked to me in English, which was later on. I said, well, I knew it was not Muhammad. And he said, just believe in me. Why you have so much doubt in me, and believe in me. And inside of me, I knew he was Jesus. And for the first time, I was able to see through the veil the reality of Jesus.
Ellie's family didn't see it that way.
I was the firstborn in my family, and you're supposed to set an example for the rest of your brothers and sisters.
They all sensed Ellie's newfound peace, but Islam required that her family disown her.
And is there any curiosity on their part to know about this Jesus that has brought you real peace?
Well, for the first time after 14 years, I met them a few months ago in Istanbul, Turkey, and they were able to hear the word. the gospel, the truth.
And how did they respond?
They were very quiet. Of course, I think it's sometimes hard to receive from your children, especially in Middle Eastern culture. That was the first time they met my husband, too, so I led them to establish the relationship, and we tried to just be a living word to them, because that is what the Muslim observe mostly, to see how you act, how you talk, because you don't want to win their heads, but you want to win their hearts.
Some people would argue today that God and Allah are the same. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
Well, it absolutely can be, because God cannot deny himself our impurities for our sicknesses and disease. He was crucified. He was the perfect sacrifice. Versus in Islam, they deny the deity and lordship of Jesus Christ. So how come God can deny himself?
Ellie and her husband, Surik, are committed to reaching Muslims with the truth. They use conferences, their website, and even TV to get their message to those who will listen.
I know there are lots of Muslims, they are trying to please a God who cannot even hear them or listens to them. I'm not talking about a dead God, I'm not talking about a distant God. I am talking about a God who is alive, who is able to hear the deep down cries of our hearts and listen to us and say, hear my son, hear my daughter, come to me. His arms is so large, open with love to receive all of them and fill their hearts with grace, with peace, with joy.
An amazing, amazing testimony from an Iranian lady. Iranians are finding the joy and the purpose, the fulfillment of their life is in a person. It's in a relationship, and it's certainly not in a religion, and they find that in Jesus. And you see this constant thread, this commonality in almost every single testimony of Iranians. Islam did not fulfill them. Islam was bondage to them. And they saw it in everyday life, the way the government treated them, the way they were restricted in freedom, the way that they were told to live. It was a religion. And every time I do this program, I always talk about this distinction, religion versus relationship. And there is such a difference. And I can't do better than what Ellie did. She experienced the dark side of Islam. She experienced what it's like to live under oppression and fear. And then she experienced the freedom, the fulfillment of what it's like to live in the presence of God through knowing Christ. I talked to you earlier about something going on in Iran that you don't hear a whole lot about. It's the suicide rate among women. There are some women, unfortunately, sadly and tragically, that don't find that hope like Ellie did. And for whatever reasons, known unto God, I don't know why. But I have a friend named Nassim, who's a wonderful human rights advocate for women. And she speaks out. She doesn't live in Iran. She lives somewhere else, not necessary to tell you where. And she speaks out for women's rights in every culture. And one day she shared with me the sad, sad tragedy of her sister. And I asked her, please, Nassim, write something about this. I want to share it with people. I want people to know about the suicide rate in Iran, because this is something that happened tragically to her sister. And what I want to do with our remaining time, I want to read what she wrote to me. And this is a subject we really need to explore more deeply, how sad it is that women take their life in Iran. She writes, women are main victims of suicide in Iran. The most common form of suicide amongst women in Iran is self-immolation, which is in protest society dictating their lives to them. The number of attempted suicides is much higher. Women and girls in particular find it hard to face society where misogyny and discrimination against women have been institutionalized by the clerical regime. Torturing women by their families is one of the most important elements of women's suicide. Most of them die for nothing. They kill themselves because of their inner pain that they have carried from childhood till the time they are given an end to their miserable life. It also happens in highly educated families, too, Nassim writes. Even these people have patriarchal thoughts and behaviors. Some families try to show up that they are civilized, but when you really get to know them very well, you will find out that they are far from that category. And then she writes about her sister. Shabnam Bazeri was a 14-year-old girl from Borjazan, which is located in the south of Iran, who committed suicide because of the patriarchal and male-dominated situation of her family and society of Iran. And she killed herself by setting herself on fire. She was really a brave and active girl with lots of great expectations who suffered a lot at home, school, and society that she lived in. All of these factors made her hopeless of her life, and she decided to put an end to it. And they buried her in her hometown of Borjazan. Her classmates brought flowers and put it on her seat where she was sat in school for weeks. And this particular young girl, Shabnam, had a favorite poet. Iran is so well known for their poetry. And the name of the poet that she really enjoyed was Ahmad Shamlu, the Iranian poetry of liberty. He was a humanist and a socially minded intellectual. And he, in his poem, skillfully weaves personal love and affection and social attitudes together. And this poem is written on her graves. It's a poem called Ada in the Mirror by Ahmad Shamlu. It's a very, very long poem. And part of the poems that's really, really profound is it talks about this burning. And it talks about what she did to her own body. And it says in part, your lips, delicate as poetry, turn the most voluptuous kiss into such a coyness that the cave animal uses it to become human. Even an animal can become human because of your kiss. And your cheeks with two oblique lines that lead your pride in my destiny, I who have endured the night without being armed in anticipation of the dawn and have brought back a proud virginity sealed from the brothels of barter. And he goes on in this very long, really intellectually well thought out poem called Ada in the Mirror. But I want to bring up Shabnam as an example of the hopelessness and despair that goes on in Iran. You and me have a part to play in bringing the light of Christ to dispel the darkness of that despair in Iran. And part of that, what we have to do is praying for the people of Iran, praying for their salvation, praying for their justice, praying for their freedom. So we have a part to play. When you listen to this program, your participation is so important. And if all you can do is spend time in praying for them, I want to recommend a book to you through Alam Ministries that will help you pray practically every day for a month. It's called Iran 30. Just go to iran30.org and you can get a free copy of this. But it's a daily prayer guide for the people of Iran. And when I think of Shabnam and the hopelessness and despair that she endured because of the culture she lived in, it's really hard. It's painful for me. And then I think of what Jesus said. You know, Jesus dealt with religion. He dealt with hypocrites. He dealt with false prophets. He dealt with those that promised freedom but gave bondage. He saw what the teachings of the Pharisees and the scribes, the weights it put on people, the expectations, what you need to do to raise yourself to this standard. He saw how false religion destroyed people. And then he said to them, under despair and hopelessness, he said, come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Let me teach you, because I'm humble and gentle in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. That's the rest that Shabnam needed so desperately. This is the rest that Ellie found. And this is the rest and the hope that Muslims can find in Jesus. He says, come to me, Don't go to your religious manual. Don't put the heavy burdens on yourself. Don't do that to yourself. No, no. Come to me. I will give you rest. That's a message of hope for my Iranian friends that are hurting, that are struggling. You know, just before I came on the show today, one of my friends, Nahid, that lives in Tehran, she says, I'm just feeling empty and I'm feeling lonely. And I shared with her the message of Christ because she's a friend of mine and she knows me. But I want to share with her at her need what I believe will make a difference in her life, will change and transform her life. The message of Jesus is what Iranian people need. They don't need any more religion. They don't need any more rules or regulations. There's no freedom there. But when you come to the God of the Bible, the God of the Bible says, I am a God of love. One of the statements, 1 John 4:10, God is love. You won't find that in the Quran. You won't find that in religion, but you will find that in Jesus. It says God is love. That is the essence of who he is. It's an unconditional love, no strings attached. But let me say this to you. When you come to the God of the Bible, the God of love, you will have a freedom that is beyond anything you could even ask or think. And that's why when Jesus says, come to me, you who carry heavy burdens, and you who are weary from the weight of false religion, I know about that, Jesus says. I'm going to give you rest from all of that. That's a promise. And I love the language of Jesus because it's the language of relationship. The language of relationship, not of more heavy burdens, not of more do's and don'ts. Don't do this, don't do that. And pretty soon, there's nothing left for you to do because you're squeezed into a corner. Muslims have found in Jesus that hope and freedom and rest. Muslims see in Jesus the way that he treats women. When he was here, the way he lifted women out of their circumstances. I'm thinking of the woman caught in adultery. He forgave her. And those that accused her walked away and dropped their stones from stoning her. I see the way that Jesus treated women, and now I understand why Muslim women are flocking, if you will, are attracted, if you will, are coming to Jesus. Because they see in him the way that a man ought to treat a woman with dignity and respect. And you see that throughout the Bible. Oh, I have my atheist friends that try to tell me the Bible is anti-woman and talk about certain passages of Scripture, always taken out of context. But the bottom line is this. In Christ, you have rest, you have hope, and you have freedom. And Jesus says to you, if you're struggling today, if you're struggling in false religion today, Jesus says, come to me. How do you come to Jesus? It's really simple. Every Muslim I have ever talked to, in their prayer time, when they're feeling lonely and helpless, they just cry out, Jesus, if you're real, help me. Real simple. Notice that. It's not some form of ritual. It's from your heart. Jesus, come and help me. Come and save me. It's that simple. That's how you come to him. You don't go through the hand-washing ritual, wadu. You don't prepare that way. You come as you are, just as you are, because that's the case of all of us. All of us have sinned. All of us fall short of God's glory every day. We are guilty. We know it. We can do nothing to clean ourselves up. We can do nothing to change our nature. That's why Jesus says, I know all of that. Come to me, you who are weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest. So today, if you hear this message and you're struggling with hopelessness and despair, come to Jesus. I can promise you he will hear you. I can promise you that he will give you rest. Because that's why this is called the cross in the desert. You can picture that man in the desert, on his knees, man or woman, struggling, wanting rest, wanting water, thirsty, tired, hungry. And there's the cross in the desert. There's his hope. There's her hope. It's just that simple. We dare not make this complicated. So Jesus is calling you today. Come to him. I really want to hear from you. I really want to know what you're thinking. You can come to my Facebook page anytime, Randy L. Noble. You can friend request me. I will be happy to correspond with you. My email address, rnoble1065@sbcglobal.net. Next month on our special two-hour program, we have got an incredible guest who knows the human rights situation in Iran. She knows the laws. She knows how Iran came to be the way it was since the revolution. She is a human rights expert, extraordinarily gifted lady. Her name is Shadi Paveh. And she is going to be my special guest. You will want to hear what she has to say. She knows the happenings in Iran. Her father was killed under Khomeini simply because he opposed the revolutionary regime. You really, really want to hear from her. I really thank you so much for spending time with me here today. Thank you, Kelly, for an outstanding job behind the scenes. I appreciate you listening to The Cross in the Desert. I want to say goodbye to you.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
I love it. I love it. One of my favorite sound points from Kelly. I want to say God bless you. Thank you for listening to The Cross in the Desert. I will see you next month with Shadi Paveh as my special guest. Goodbye for now.
Into the darkness you shine, out of the